Good morning and welcome to the June 24th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. This is a special edition of Mountain Money. One of the great things about this job is we get to talk to some of the most interesting people in the country who write some of the most interesting books. And this week, we got a chance to look back and select some of our favorites. The first interview you will hear was an interview with Richard Thaler. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he wrote a book called Nudge. Nudge really deals with the concept of choice architecture. How do we structure choices to facilitate people making choices that we think are beneficial? So, for example, when you drive down 224 and see silhouettes of animals, you're trying to nudge people to slow down. You will enjoy the conversation with Thaler. Then we talked to Ben McKenzie. He's the former OC star who wrote a book about his experiences while during the pandemic being bored and starting to explore crypto. Eventually, McKenzie concluded that crypto is a scam. He documented it in his book, Easy Money, and talked about it with us. We finish our hour by airing an interview with Ryan Lewis about his business, Wasatch Ski Chairs. Do you remember the old red pine gondolas that Park City decommissioned? Well, Lewis came up with the idea of refurbishing them and selling them. You'll find the interview very interesting. All this and more coming up right after this. This morning, I wanted to buy some decomposable coffee pods from a website. It was a frustrating experience because it seemed the only way to buy the pods was to sign up for a monthly subscription, which would have cost too much and left me over-caffeinated. Eventually, by actually leaving the site and doing a second search, I was able to find a hidden part of the website that would allow me to make a single purchase.
The company's decision to organize its website in such a frustrating way is an exercise in what is called choice architecture. Choice architecture is the act of organizing the context in which people make decisions. And choice architecture is everywhere, from school cafeteria arrays to retirement options offered by employers to healthcare plans. So what principles can and should choice architects utilize in arraying choices? How do people analyze and make choices? And what gets in the way of good decision-making, something that our guest today describes as sludge?
This morning, we are joined by Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler, the co-author of Nudge. Nudge is a deep and surprisingly humorous dive into how we make choices and how and why we can and should be nudged in different directions. We are so pleased that he has made the choice to join us this morning. Good morning, Professor Thaler.
Good morning. And I will point out that it was the default option for me to join.
Early in the book, you used the example that I just referenced of a school cafeteria to sort of explain the overall concept of choice architecture. Can you lay that out for our audience as background for our discussion?
Sure. So the idea is we have this imaginary person who, let's say, is in charge of all the school cafeterias for the city of Chicago and would like the kids to eat healthier foods. And thinks about, well, how could you do that? And decides to run some experiments. They don't change the food they serve. They just rearrange how it's organized. And what she discovers is, if you put the apples where kids can see them and take them, they eat more apples and fewer Twinkies. And this is a made-up example, but it appeared in the first edition of the book, but then people tried it, and not surprisingly, it works. So it's an example both of choice architecture and nudging. So putting the healthy food up front is a nudge, and it's a nudge for good. The experience you had buying coffee pods was sludge, which is nudge for evil. When you go to a supermarket and all the stuff in the checkout line that's in easy reach of toddlers sitting in the cart is not the stuff that mom or dad wants the toddler to eat.
So you talked about, I guess, bad structure of these types of things, but perhaps go into what is paternalistic libertarianism and how should it drive choice architecture?
So libertarian paternalism is our preferred order. And so it is an odd phrase. And the fact that it annoys people. It was part of the appeal. But the idea is that, say, rearranging the order of the food is paternalistic in that we're trying to help the kids choose a healthier lunch, but it's libertarian in that we're not forcing anybody to do anything. Cass and I both love GPS because we're hopeless when it comes to getting around. We're always lost. Both of us rely on our wives to tell us where to go. But GPS, you know, when our wife isn't handy, GPS is a good substitute. And in our ideal world, there would be GPS for everything. And GPS lets you set where you want to go, but you can change your mind. And that's the way life ought to be. And, you know, when you're searching for coffee pods, it would be nice if the choice architecture led you to the most desirable option rather than the one that's most profitable for the seller.
And I apologize for bollocksing up libertarian paternalism. But it was interesting to me that, as you said before, those terms are seemingly contradictory. One doesn't associate paternalism with libertarians. So what I think you were trying to get at, and what I gathered from it, was that the concept of the libertarian comes from the fact that you're not limiting the choice. Have I got that right?
Exactly. We use libertarian as an adjective. It's a kind of paternalism. The phrase was invented on the fly when I was giving a talk here at the University of Chicago about a program that a student of mine and I invented called Save More Tomorrow. And the idea was you go to people in a 401k plan and say, would you like to sign up for a plan where you increase your saving contributions every year when you get a raise? It's voluntary. It's opt-in. Now, at this conference, there was an assigned discussant, which is normally assigned somebody to trash the paper in public in front of you. So my discussant said, well, yeah, this seems to work, but wait, isn't this paternalism, which is a curse word at the University of Chicago? And I said, well, you know, normally we think of paternalism as coercive. And you have to buckle your seatbelt. This seems to be a different kind of paternalism. I don't know, maybe we could call it libertarian paternalism, which of course he hated. But the next day at lunch with my buddy Cass Sunstein, I said, hey, you know, Cass, I came up with an interesting phrase yesterday at this conference that seemed to annoy my discussant to no end. Maybe we should write a book about this. And, you know, there we go. The rest is history.
Well, and I think there's multiple ways to look at why it's important to offer and have offerings in this way, because, you know, traditional economics assume that people are rational actors, which I think we understand that we're not, you know, and we do seek optimum outcomes. But, you know, you talk about offering a different take and discussing, you know, concepts of human versus econs. So can you explain that?
Sure. So anybody who's ever taken an economics course knows that the creatures you study in an economics textbook are not people you've ever met. They can look at all the healthcare options offered by your employer and immediately figure out the best one. And the same with choosing a mortgage. And they never overeat. They eat just the right amount. So we call these fictional creatures econs. Econs never have a hangover because they don't drink too much. they save just the right amount for retirement. So, you know, back when I was in graduate school, I kept saying, really? You know, those aren't the people I know. So I've spent my career saying, you know, really? And so we say, no, there are not econs. There are humans. And we know humans can't make these kinds of calculations and sometimes have self-control problems, but are also nicer than economists give people credit for. They contribute to NPR, to charities, and clean up after campgrounds and clean up their dog mess, which economists think nobody would do. So Nudge is a book that says, what can we do to help humans? And, you know, economists, the Latin phrase for econs is homo economicus. And we say we study Homer economicus because we study Homer Simpson. And we're trying to create a world that is safe for Homer Simpson. And Homer would need a lot of help.
So you talk about some of the things that differentiate our Homer person from our econ. Share with us some of the things that humans do that distorts their decision-making and would be helped by nudges.
Well, you know, one is status quo bias. So we stick with what is done. And how many times have you been told, when you say, why do we have to do it this way? And the answer is, that's the way we do it. Or that's the way we've always done it. Now, you know, there's the song and Fiddler on the Roof, tradition. Now, traditions are fine, but sometimes traditions are stupid. And we're just doing something because that's the way we've always done it. Status quo bias also leaves us continuing to do things even when we should change. So once you become aware of status quo bias, then you can say, oh, wait a minute, I'm falling into a trap here. And being aware of what those traps are helps protect you against some of the most common mistakes.
So knowing what the traps are, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the segment, Rogers going out and finding the coffee in the pods, but that it wasn't set up in the correct way. You know, it was set up to maximize profit, not necessarily to maximize the best decision-making process. Is that what sludge is, or is it also something else?
Well, it's partly that, but As we talked about, the government emits a lot of sludge as well. So companies may be trying to maximize profits. Governments, the phrase that law professors like Cass like to use is administrative burdens, which is sludge in and of itself, just that phrase. But the fact that you have to fill out a lot of forms to get some government benefit, that's an example of sludge. There is a new child credit that the poorest people will have the most trouble getting because they have to fill out some forms, and it's automatic if you've been paying taxes and have a bank account. Now, think of the typical homeless person or person living on the edge. If you don't make enough money, you don't have to pay tax, and you may not have a bank account. So the people who need the money most have the most trouble getting it. Does that make sense?
It does. And this is far and away been the most interesting and humorous conversation I can ever recall having with a professor of economics. And I was an economics major, so we really appreciate you taking the time with us. I know we're going to run out of time soon, but I wanted to touch on something you discussed in the last chapter, which is you're talking about climate change and the traditional economics challenge of dealing with public goods. Can you share with us a little bit about your observations as to how choice architecture could help with the climate change problem?
Sure. So, you know, the economists define a public good as something that everybody can share and will tend not to contribute to. So, you know, here in Chicago, there's a fireworks display twice a week at Navy Pier. I happen to live in a place in Lincoln Park where I see it from one of my windows. I don't have to pay for that. And it would be hard, you know, the mayor needs money, but she can't collect from me because there's no way to turn it off for me. So the economic theory says people won't contribute to public goods. But people are nicer than economists give them credit for. And so they will. And what experiments have shown is you can increase the extent to which people will do the right thing and contribute to the public good if people can punish people who don't. So how can we use that in dealing with climate change? Well, one of the many problems with climate change is we have to get all the countries to agree. And so the U.S. says, look, we don't want to, say, put in a carbon tax, which is what every economist, every 100% of economists say we need to have a carbon tax. But the U.S. says, well, look, we don't want to do that unless China and India do it. And they're emitting the most emissions. And China and India say, look, that's recent. The U.S. got rich by making all these emissions. So the U.S. should be cleaning up their act. Well, this isn't getting us anywhere. So what we need to do is something like the Paris Accord. We have to all agree to do our share. And the idea we endorse, which was proposed by Bill Nordhaus, an economist at Yale, is he calls them climate clubs. We're not sure that's the best name for it. But the idea would be all the countries would agree to do this and would agree to punish countries that don't take up their part of the deal, maybe through tariffs or something like that. So the other thing I'd like to say about climate change is, and one of the things we stress in the final edition of this book is that there are many things. Well, let me say it this way. Nudge can help almost any problem, including climate change. Nudge is not the solution to climate change. It's way too big. We're going to have to do some big things, and we have to get the prices right. That's step one. But nudges can help, and they can help with this. And there are lots of, you know, we get text messages now. If the heat is high and we're threatening the power grid, that's a nudge. That can help. And nudges may help 1-2%, but, and that's good. You know, President Obama used to like to say, good, better is good, you know? So every little bit helps, but that problem is so big, we're going to have to go beyond nudging. And that's what we say in the new book.
We've been talking with Professor Richard Thaler, who is a co-author with Professor Cass Sunstein of Nudge, the final edition. Thank you for spending time with us. Mountain Money will be right back after this. As I was preparing for this morning's interview, I really came to my, what came to my mind were two prior interviews we've done here on Mountain Money. One was with Laura Shin, who wrote the book Kryptonians, a detailed explanation and delve into the state of the crypto industry that featured issues like, why was the new Ethereum model going to require less currency? And then there was our Super Bowl 21 ad issue, where we talked about why was it that all of a sudden there were more crypto ads than beer? Both of these things had one thing in common, which is, try as I might, I didn't get it. And that was what was so much fun about this weekend's book, Easy Money. Because what Ben McKenzie has done is finally written a book on cryptocurrency that explains why it is I didn't get it. And the reason is, there's not that much there. Good morning, Ben, and welcome to Mountain Money.
I can't tell you how much I'm smiling right now, because that's exactly what I want people to understand. It's not you. It's just a story. It's just a story. Unfortunately, it's not a true story.
And it is quite a story. Let's talk a little bit. One of the great things I liked about this book was that, sort of like those movies or plays that are plays about the making of a play or the making of a movie, this is a book about the writing of a book. Tell us a little bit about how you came to write it and how long did it take?
Sure. In the spring, summer of 2021, I had a lot of time on my hands. I'm an actor by trade, and showbiz was really put on ice during the COVID pandemic for obvious reasons. So I was sitting at home, bored. Basically, long story short, I got FOMO, a fear of missing out. You know, that there are all these folks, you know, we were all sitting around our phones and devices, and the internet was awash with people making tons of money on things like crypto. And I have a degree in economics. I hadn't used it much in 20 years in showbiz, but I dusted it off, started kind of paying attention to what was going on in the markets and trying to make sense of it. And around that time, a buddy of mine came to me and said I should buy Bitcoin. And, you know, most people can probably relate to this. Almost everyone's had someone try to get them to buy crypto. The difference was, and I do love my friend, he had given me terrible financial advice when I was in my 20s. He encouraged me to buy stock in this company. It's kind of a shady company. We probably lost most of our money. He wasn't obviously scamming me. He was excited, and I was excited by his excitement, and, you know, we lost some money. So when he came to me 20 years later, I just paused and I checked that econ book. And one of the things that just puzzled me was the word currency. Actually, most people know that one of the things that you can do with money is buy stuff. And yet with these cryptos, you couldn't really buy anything. So they seem like investments, but if they were investments, they seem like they were kind of unregulated and unlicensed investments. And that's really what started me down the journey. I reached out to a journalist and we started reporting on this and sold the book and kept reporting on the proposal. Took about, it's almost been 2 years since I've been working on this.
And it was key for us to, you know, have you start off with, you argue that cryptocurrencies are not currencies. So maybe get into that just a little bit more. What are they?
Sure. So in economics, currencies do three things. They're a medium of exchange, which means you can buy and sell stuff with them. The first thing that I had mentioned before. They're a unit of account, meaning you can run your books with them. And they're a store of value, meaning their value stays relatively consistent over time. Money's made up. It's not real, right? It's a social construct, just like government or religion. So all currencies are, you know, fallible. They're potentially fragile. In the United States, we're blessed to have been the world's reserve currency since post-World War II. So we sort of don't think about how unstable other currencies can be, but ours is actually quite stable. Cryptocurrencies couldn't do any of the three of the things that money was supposed to do. As a medium of exchange, they weren't being used like that, and they couldn't work actually because of the technology itself. The proof of work that Bitcoin relies on, all these computers performing simple mathematical calculations over, Bitcoin can only handle 5 to 7 transactions a second, and it consumes an enormous amount of energy in the process. Visa can do 24,000. So as a payments method, you know, Bitcoin was just never going to work. So medium of exchange was out. Unit and account and store of value were out because the volatility was so much. I mean, crypto prices jump around like a rabbit on amphetamines. I mean, they're just all over the place. So there was no way you could really use cryptocurrency as a real form of money. So none of the three functions were satisfied. And then, of course, they weren't being used that way. I mean, people were buying crypto, usually through apps on their phone, with real money, and then hoping that the crypto would go up in price, and then at some point they could sell it and convert it back into real money, and then they could buy, you know, whatever they wanted with it. Well, that's an investment. I mean, it's quite simple. Under American law, investment contracts have been regulated at the federal level since the 1930s, because in the 1920s they weren't, and you could do anything you wanted in the market, and the Roaring 20s was a lot of fun, until 1929, the crash that led to the Great Depression, and the powers that be realized we needed some rules. So it was pretty ironic, but about a century later, it felt like we were revisiting a time before we had effective securities regulation in this country, and 20,000 of these so-called cryptocurrencies were being sold to the general public, and yet they really looked like penny stocks.
One of the wonderful things about this book is the nature of the journey as you go through various adventures, ranging from drinking with ostensible CIA agents to playing Monopoly Junior with your daughter. I want to get to some of those adventures, but there's one other sort of principled point that I took away that I thought was really important, which was almost the sister to this isn't a currency, which is what are the characteristics of a Ponzi scheme?
Yeah, great question. So there are actually, you can go to the SEC's website. They have a page devoted to this, which is the seven red flags for Ponzi schemes. Crypto checks off five, arguably six of the seven. I'm not sure I could list them all off the top of my head, but some of them are unregulated, unlicensed, right? If they're not being traded through a regulated, if they are not licensed themselves. Another is if they are not being sold through a licensed exchange. Another is guaranteed return on your money. You know, somebody will say, we can guarantee you, 10% return. That's impossible. I'm not a licensed financial advisor, but any licensed financial advisor should be able to tell you that's impossible. All investments carry risk. And anytime you are, quote unquote, guaranteeing above market risk, you are lying. You can't guarantee above market risk. So there, the fact that crypto checked off five or six of the seven was really kind of stunning to me. And the fact that they were being sold in such a public way on social media, but also television and Super Bowl by some of the most famous people on earth, it made me think, well, there are only really two, kind of outcomes here. Either I'm crazy, I've lost my mind, which, given the pandemic and the stress, maybe that's true. Or this is potentially one of the biggest frauds in history. 40 to 50 million Americans bought cryptocurrency because they were sold it by some of the most famous people on earth. It felt like a story that I sort of had to write. I needed help with that, and Jacob Silverman, a journalist, helped me with it tremendously. But it just felt like if I was right, this was going to be a big story and potentially quite an adventure. And boy, it turned out to be.
Let's go into that first article that you published with Jacob Silverman. It was published on October 7th, 2021, titled Celebrity Crypto Shilling is a Moral Disaster. Talk about the importance of the article and the path to shed light on this.
So I came to this conclusion that crypto was potentially a massive Ponzi scheme or a multi-level marketing scheme. And I felt like I wanted to write a book, but didn't know how. So I reached out to Jacob in August of 2021 and pitched him on this somewhat crazy idea that we would write a book that I don't know how to write about events that haven't happened yet. What could possibly go wrong? And it was interesting, I didn't see this myself. He pointed out that we should write articles to sort of prove our bona fides to sell to the idea of a book to a publisher. And we should start our articles with a celebrity article because, of course, I am one, admittedly somewhat less famous than some of the people that showed crypto. And so that would get us some attention and some buzz. And it was, I fully believed in the truth of it. I was kind of aghast at my colleagues for shilling this stuff because as long as there have been celebrities have been shilling products. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But this is not car insurance. This is not soap. I mean, these are financial products, unregulated, unlicensed financial products, and you're encouraging people to invest their real money in them. That sounds terrible to me. So, yes, I mean, I guess the headline kind of tells you everything you need to know about how aggressive we wanted to be here, but we really did want to say, at a minimum, the celebrities need to cut this stuff out. And that kind of started us on our journey and got us enough attention to where folks inside and outside of the crypto industry wanted to talk to us about what they had seen. We were given tips from various different people, and we were able to start working our way up the crypto industry's somewhat pyramid-like structure.
One of the keys to having crypto really work would be the ability to exchange crypto, as you said before, for something else of value. Let's talk a little bit about Tether. Why was it important for there to be a stable coin company, right? And what happened to Tether?
So Tether's still around. It's quite large. It is supposedly worth $83 billion. Tether is a stable coin, meaning that its value is linked one-to-one with a real currency, or at least supposedly. So a Tether, one Tether in the crypto exchanges, crypto casinos is really how I like to make them, one Tether equals $1, or at least it's traded as such. So the reason that stablecoins are so important for the cryptocurrency market is once you've bought your crypto, if you want to trade it for other cryptos, still stay inside of the crypto market, but not be exposed to the volatility of the other cryptocurrencies, you can transfer over to a stablecoin and your crypto dollar stays the same amount. If you come out of the crypto world, you're going to have to pay taxes on the money that you've earned. And you're going to have to go through a licensed bank account. And you know, there's a lot of money sort of sloshing through the crypto ecosystem that comes from dubious sources. Most of the volume in the crypto industry runs through the overseas exchanges. These are exchanges like FTX that was headquartered in the Bahamas, as well as Binance, which is the largest crypto exchange and has been the largest crypto exchange since 2018. Binance, it says it doesn't have a headquarters, so it's hard to say exactly where it's based, but it is run through at least some shell corporations in the Caribbean. So as soon as you start talking about things like that, where, you know, this company Tether that's dealing in, you know, tens of billions of dollars that has never been audited, that seems to have a workforce of a dozen people, you know, they have fewer people than my neighborhood deli, the red flags are just kind of, you know, well, they're obvious, right? It was kind of astounding to me that it had gotten so big. But once you sort of, Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC, I think has a good metaphor here. Stablecoins are the poker chips in the casino. You know, if you want to play the games, you buy the tethers and you trade them for this or that cryptocurrency. And it's all well and good unless you go to the teller to cash out into real money and the teller's window is closed. And unfortunately, that's happened with a number of stable coins. They turned out not to be so stable. One of them blew up in May of last year, and that began the collapse.
Which is kind of our segue into what happened in May of 2021 with Binance, which is an amazing story. For those of us who are used to being able to, you know, think of trading on our Schwab account, we push the button, the trade happens. Talk to us a little bit about what happened there and what it tells you about whether this game is really rigged in more ways than we know.
Sure. So in May of 2021, the price of crypto suddenly collapsed. I say it went from about 50,000 in Bitcoin to 40,000 in minutes, and other cryptocurrencies similarly crashed. And so Jacob and I wrote an article for the Washington Post looking at two different traders. One of them was in Canada, and he was long. He thought the price was going to go up, so he held a bunch of cryptocurrency. And the other one was in Australia, and he was short. He thought the prices were going to go down. He bet against it. So in May, when the prices collapsed, the guy that was long wanted to get out of his positions because he saw his value dropping. The guy that was short just wanted to cash in and take his profits. Well, it started clicking. App wasn't working. It jumped the computer. Wasn't working again. One of the guys even had, I think he had three different computers set up for just such an occasion when maybe his Wi-Fi was out or whatever, and none of them were working. So Binance, which is the biggest crypto exchange, you know, in the world, as I mentioned, they were both on Binance, and Binance just stopped working. It just wouldn't work. And eventually it came back on, but the price of Bitcoin had magically gone back up. And so the guy that was long had been instantaneously liquidated. There was no margin call. He was just wiped out. And the guy that was short, because the position had gone back up to about where it was before the crash, his profits were gone. And he had a little bit of money left, and he ended up losing it. So I can't think of a more sort of simple narrative than it didn't matter whether you were long or short. Whatever position you were in, you were going to lose. It's hard to kind of come up with a more illustrative example of the game's rigged. You know, as soon as you're putting your money onto these the overseas ones, there's no investor protections. You know, it's at best, it's gambling in an unregulated, unlicensed casino. And at worst, it's just straight up fraud.
Being scammed seems to be a defining part of the crypto culture. So why do crypto investors accept being scammed as a rite of passage?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think in terms of the people that we talk to, of course, a lot of very just sort of regular folks, as well as people like Sam Bankman-Fried. It's treated as a badge of honor. It's treated as a, you know, kind of like a necessary step in kind of mastering the ability to trade crypto, right? Everyone just goes, oh, yeah, you know, I scammed and I learned my lesson. In crypto, they call it DYOR, do your own research, meaning that, you know, you're responsible for anything that happens to you. Which, you know, look, it could be tempting to kind of go, well, yes, you're responsible for your investment decisions. I don't think anyone really, you know, kind of disputes that. But there's a massive difference between being responsible for your investment decisions and, you know, being responsible for an app shutting down completely or somebody hacking into your account and stealing all your crypto or, you know, things like this happen in crypto all the time. And I think the sort of notion of financial self-sovereignty, they call it, is very appealing, particularly to young men. But unfortunately, the net result is that most of them lose money. And then their anger that would otherwise be directed towards potentially the people that scammed them and thought of them is instead turned backwards onto themselves. So they end up blaming themselves for something that may or may not have been their fault. Pretty grim.
It's interesting as you talk about it, you know, you talk about the appeal to young men, and it sounds a lot like the same appeal to the online sports gambling that also exploded during the pandemic. I wanted to ask you about Sam Bankman-Fried. You mentioned among the many fascinating people you got a chance to talk to, and it was really extraordinary, the number of interesting people you ended up talking to that are outlined in the book. Talk to us a little bit about your impressions of Bankman-Fried.
So I interviewed Sam in July of last year. So this was several months before his empire fell apart and he ended up getting charged with fraud. At the time, crypto was weakened in May. This stablecoin, quote-unquote stablecoin, turned out to be not so stable and fell apart. Terra Luna, so it was called. And basically a bunch of companies were either bankrupt or about to be so. And Sam, however, was being viewed as the J.P. Morgan of crypto. He was going to save the industry. He was going to buy up these failing companies, and he was going to clean up the industry and present it to the American public as a safer way to invest in crypto. That's how they market it themselves. And so Sam was spending a lot of time on Capitol Hill, gaining the ear of regulators and lawmakers. And he agreed to be interviewed, which was somewhat surprising given that we were writing a book about crypto and fraud and it was in our Twitter profiles and it had been announced by the press. But, you know, to his credit, I guess, he agreed. It was one of the strangest hours of my life. I had at that point, Jacob and I had worked our way up to what at least was being marketed as the pinnacle of the crypto industry. I mean, it couldn't get more public than Sam. He was the face of the industry. And so I assumed when interviewing him that he could explain crypto to me in a way that made sense because everyone else that I talked to before hadn't been able to. And yet I found his answers completely unsatisfying, if not, you know, potentially either manipulative or deceptive. And so I walked away from that interview thinking, oh boy, you know, if he's the head of this thing, then, you know, unfortunately, I think there's worse to come.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time. I have to tell you, as a fellow economics major at the University of Virginia, I'm proud of what you're doing, and I suspect Dr. Elzinga is too. But as we...
I didn't know you went to UVA. That's wonderful. Love Elzinga. Oh, that's terrific.
He taught us so much, didn't he? Let's talk about where we go from here, Ben. What's the future of crypto? Is it going to stay around as a significant financial weapon, or is it going to sort of go up in smoke like tulips?
Right. Well, you know, I like to say I can't predict the future any more than anyone else. And that's one of the things that separates me from someone who might be scamming you or defrauding you. We'll say that, you know, they're not necessarily humble. And that's one of the signs that, you know, you might be being had. So I don't know the future. That being said, regulators are finally catching up. Prosecutors, law enforcement officials are finally catching up. And for all this talk of decentralization, the crypto industry is actually heavily centralized. There's actually very few players who really matter. And I will just say there's probably a lot more to come, is all I'll say, if I had to guess. And so once the fraud's been washed out, and I believe there is a heck of a lot of fraud, potential fraud here, we'll see what's left. But we need to understand that the building blocks of cryptocurrency are not new. Blockchain is over 30 years old. And so we really should be asking ourselves, given the enormous social harm that crypto does in the form of both regular people getting swindled and facilitating criminal activity, you know, cryptocurrencies really only have two use cases, gambling and crime. We should really ask ourselves whether this should be allowed to exist, or whether, and if it should, shouldn't it be regulated stringently? Because we're talking about economically zero-sum games. They don't add value. It's not like the stock market where the companies issue stock, they get that money, and then they can invest that money into their businesses that the thing grow. And so over time, the stock market grows. Crypto can't do that. It's more like poker, so at best. So I think we need to start asking those questions, but we'll probably only really get a chance to ask those once, you know, things have fallen further and the fraud's been addressed to some degree.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with author Ben McKenzie about his book, Easy Money, Cryptocurrency, Casino Capitalism, and the Golden Age of Fraud. Ben, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Wasatch Ski Chairs offers an expanding catalog of authentic, professionally fabricated ski lift furniture. Ryan Lewis is the founder and CEO of Wasatch Ski Chairs and joins us this morning to talk about his unique business. Ryan, good morning.
Thanks for having me in studio.
So talk to us about this idea of making and selling furniture from actual ski lift chairs.
Yeah. I'm also the owner of Meta Designs, a custom metal fabrication shop. And being in the Mountain West here, we've often received requests from people that have purchased ski lifts or ski chairs from the ski resorts and had a problem. What do you do with it? So we've custom fabricated bases and hangers and whatever else anybody wants to turn their ski chair into.
So knowing that you know, you were originally starting with, you know, people coming to you and kind of solving a problem they have, it looks now like you kind of took more of a front seat on this and now are actually one of the people that procure the chairs. Can you talk a little bit about how you source your materials, these ski chairs?
Yeah. We had the opportunity a couple years ago through working with Snowbird to purchase the GAD 2 chairlift that they decommissioned in 2013. So we had 100 chairs, and this was the start. This was the seed and the opportunity to then recondition all of them and then sell those as reconditioned ski chairs.
That's a lot of chairs.
It was a lot of chairs.
Were they kept there, or did you have to inventory them somewhere?
Snowbird, as many resorts, have a lot of storage, right? So they kept them around in storage since 2013, just collecting dust.
Now, wait, hold on. You said a lot of chairs. Give me a number. How many chairs?
There was 100 chairs from GAD 2.
Thank you.
Yes.
It's always nice to kind of get that, you know. It's all different.
Which is still a limited number of chairs.
Absolutely.
That is not a lot.
No.
Right. It's not a lot, but it takes a lot of space. So
it does.
Them inventorying it made it a lot easier for you to say, yeah, let's do this.
For sure.
Two of the products that are currently available on your website are the Snowbird GAD 2 lift chair bench, as well as the Park City Canyon's Red Pine Gondola Cabins. Tell us about those pieces of furniture and how... You know, what people, help them visualize what these are.
Sure. So being the owner of a custom metal fabrication shop, we have a ski chair. We can create that, turn that ski chair into absolutely anything. bench for a park, seating for a restaurant. We can hang it from the front porch. We can have it just be a bench that's in your home. Indoor, outdoor, doesn't matter, for a ski chair. The gondolas, the options are endless. We had the opportunity to work with Park City Community Foundation, and we purchased 11 of the Red Pine gondolas. And we have also 11 gondolas that other people purchased through the organization. So we have 22 of them total, and we've turned them into a bar for a private residence. We're working on a design for a sauna, so you can have a sauna in your backyard in an old Red Pine gondola. We considered putting one on a golf cart frame and running it down Main Street for the 4th of July parade. The options are completely endless on what you can turn one of those cabins into. And they've been absolute fun projects to take part in.
I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought the gondola would have given us limited options versus more. But you seem to be exploring that with both customers and then internally.
Correct. A client turned one into just a lounge. We upholstered all the seats, put in a table, repolished windows, new paint job. Anything can be done to those cabins.
And we actually surprisingly have listeners from six continents on the world. These things are probably difficult to ship. I'm curious, do you have out-of-state clientele?
Out of our 100 ski chairs from GAD 2, we've probably shipped 15 or 20 of them to the East Coast. Wow. These are all people that travel from around the world or wherever, and they fly here to Utah, and they ski, and they enjoy the resort. So we crate everything up and ship it out. Shipping a gondola, we'll have to have a conversation about that, but it's all possible.
So I want to go back into kind of where you started in saying that, you know, you're with Meta Designs, a custom metal fabricator. So this is almost, I don't want to say like a side hustle, but like, you know, it came to you based on a need, based on a demand that you start to grow. But talk to us a little bit about Meta. How did that start? How long has that been in place?
So Meta Designs started about 18 years ago. And prior to that, I lived here in Park City during the mid-90s, and I worked on building some homes here with a private contractor owner in Old Town. So that's sort of my roots here in Park City. And I took the construction trade and moved down to Salt Lake and started a metal fabrication shop, which has been an awesome experience because it gets us back up here to Park City to work on projects up here as well.
And I apologize because it wasn't over the weekend, but a little bit longer since I looked at yourself. But don't you do kinetic as well?
We do kinetics as well, yeah.
So again, you can do pieces like a large staircase, or you can do other things, but then also incorporate some sort of movement into that, which seems really cool.
Correct. Kinetic architecture. So windows, walls, roofs that move. With the push of a button or the turn of a wheel, you can move a entire wall and change your space completely. There's no more limits with the side of a home from the living room to the deck if you can move a wall. They're wild pieces of architecture.
And I'm curious, I'm guessing, you know, these are beautiful pieces, not just structural, but they're art as well. I'm curious how impactful you are to the economic cycles. Do you see a lot of I'm guessing right now or last year or 2 years ago was things were really, really strong and maybe things have slowed down a little bit. What have you seen in your business as interest rates have gone higher, maybe remodeling slowing down a little bit?
Well, you guys know more than anybody else with the developments going on here in Park City and the Wasatch Back. There's no lack of new construction. There's no lack of money coming here. The reaching the limits, reaching for the limits of architecture, the size of homes, what people want, the experiences they want in their homes, gives us a really good outlook for kinetic architecture.
And knowing that, you know, it's not necessarily slowed down on the demand side for you, how big is your studio? How many metal fabricators do you have? And is that a skill hard to find?
Yeah, great question. We'll start with the hard to find skill. Yes. Okay. Finding welders is not hard. Finding craftsmen is a challenge. We are yes, welders, and our medium is working with metal, but you really have to have a finish quality eye and a super detailed attention for detail. It is hard to find those employees. We look for good people that are willing to learn and really curate their craft. Our shop is 12,000 square feet down in Salt Lake, and right now we're 18 total employees.
That's solid.
And when new developments come up, like you were talking about moving walls, and I think you said moving roofs, which seemed like it would be quite a bit harder, those are probably skills you did not have 20 years ago. How do you learn those skills? Are there like craft associations that you can go to and you can learn from your peers around the nation? Or how do you make that leap to the next level?
It was a 5-minute decision from a contractor that I had worked with many times before. He asked me, he sent me a set of plans for something that was a kinetic architecture, kinetic wall. Never seen anything like this before. We studied it, had really no idea how to tackle this. And he said, I believe that you can do it. Can you do it? And it was
he
believed in me, which was a huge part, a huge push. And we said, yeah, we can figure this out and we can make this happen. And that was the first project.
So you learned on your own.
We learned on our own. A fearless attitude, I think, is key for success in business. A can-do attitude. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, as we start to wrap up our time with you, can you let our listeners know where they can find out more about Wasatch Ski Chairs as well as Meta Designs?
Yeah. You can get us at wasatchskichairs.com. You can take a look at Wasatch Ski Chairs on Instagram. And then Meta Designs is metadesignsslc.com.
There you go. We've been speaking with Ryan Lewis. He's with Wasatch Ski Chairs, and we've been just chatting about his unique business. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thank you.